and KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. It's time for Cover to Cover with Jack Foley.
This is Jack Foley, and I'm bringing back my last week's guest, who is Sean Foley. I should say Dr. Sean Foley. That's S-E-A-N, that spelling of Sean, and Foley like me. And the reason why that last name is the same as mine is because Sean Foley, Dr. Sean Foley, is my son. Now, he's not, does he want to be a doctor or a lawyer? He's not that kind of a doctor. He's a professor, and he's a professor of history at Middle Tennessee State University. And he's just published his first book. It's a wonderful book, and it's a very challenging book, and it's so well written, the challenges are real. You don't have to, the challenge is not the prose style, which it often is in many academic books. The books may be interesting in what they have to say, but the way in which they say it is not interesting at all and tends to be soporific. There's no jargon in this book, and there's a good deal of thought and insight. The book is called The Arab Gulf States Beyond Oil and Islam. And we discussed something of what that meant last week. We'll discuss a little more today, and I may have him read from the book so that you'll get a sense of the style of the book. The Arab Gulf States Beyond Oil and Islam, Lynn Reiner publishes. And Lynn is L-Y-N-N-E, Reiner, R-I-E-N-N-E-R. Publishers. Dr. Foley, welcome again to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank again. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, let's hope it's fun today, too.
Indeed, we'll see.
It's a very strange situation. Sean is recording this with me, of course, in the house in which he grew up. And so there's a kind of circle that's arrived here from his very young childhood. And there are pictures of him on the wall in that state. Right over there, there's a picture of him. And he's about, 3 days old. And now he's much older than that, and with his first book published. And it's a terrific book. It's getting some notice from all kinds of people. Now, you have mentioned to me on the previous show, and this is something we need perhaps to remark about again because it has to do with how you titled your book, about the Rentier theory. And just briefly, it's a kind of simple idea, but it's an idea that scholars decided was really a pretty good idea. The idea was that if a country like Saudi Arabia and the other Arab Gulf states, and incidentally, the Arab Gulf states are the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council, and those states are Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, UAE.
And Kuwait, yes.
I think I said Kuwait on that list. But
okay.
It's a fascinating book dealing with those states and dealing with the whole subject of Arabic culture. And when oil happened in the early 1930s, and from about 1930 to 1981 was the great era of oil in these countries, 50 years. When that happened, certain Western scholars decided they needed a model to describe what had been happening to states when they became suddenly rich with oil. Now, the oil wasn't the property of various companies like BP, but was the property of the state. And the state, therefore, could allow companies, oil companies, to get their oil in it and charge them rents. And so this theory got known as the Rentier theory. And the idea is that with all that money coming in at the top, the state could be fairly autocratic, could do pretty much what it wanted. And you wouldn't have to worry too much about elections, you wouldn't have to worry too much about pleasing the populace, etc. And there it was, that was the theory. Now, Sean looked at all that and said, wait a minute, none of those things happened. Tell us.
When we think about the rentier state, we think about oil, beginning, middle, and end of the subject. And that's what these scholars saw. They saw these states seemingly transforming before their eyes. But in reality, both on the ground and also in the perceptions of the people in these societies, things may have changed, but not radically. Indeed, there was a famous expression from the 1970s, sort of the heart of this period where everything certainly transformed, where there was expression which was, look, my father was a camel driver. I drive a Cadillac. My son flies a jet. My grandson will fly a supersonic jet. But my great-grandson, he will be a camel driver.
The oil will dry up someday.
Right. And if oil had produced the amount of transformational effects, the amount of transformation that my colleagues in the field who have done good scholarship have argued, then why is it the perception of those people that this world was so tenuous that it could go back to what it was before oil appeared on the scene?
Yeah, the mistake they seem to be making, and it's an interesting mistake, is not to understand, which is a very strange thing for historians, but not to understand that things happen, whatever happens, in a context, in a fabric of things that are already there. And there's a there before oil. And that there doesn't go away.
Well, in part of the reason for it is that most of the work that's been done on this part of the world has been done by political scientists. And although my training is both as an historian, that is my doctorate, I've done a lot of work in political science, and that's, this book is as much a book about history as it is about political science. And in fact, one of the things that I'm doing is giving to political science, saying, look, if we're going to understand the realities on the ground now or even 20 years ago, we need to understand the larger historical context, that there are continuities and changes that if we go back and look at the 1920s and 1930s, means that we look at today in a very different light.
Yeah, you saw we talked about in the other show, the cover of a National Geographic in which the monarch was not saying, yeah, I can do whatever I want, I got plenty of money. Instead, he was trying to please his populace by doing a traditional dance.
And indeed, a good example of how these continuities happen over time with no exchange. These are societies based on direct interaction between a ruler and his populace. And an average person can visit a king or a local ruler and say, you got to hear me.
And this is still the case.
Absolutely. In a way that no American citizen can walk up to, say, the president or governor or even a mayor and demand to see an audience and expect to get it. You can in these societies. And an interesting transformation, if you look at, say, Dubai, which is a city-state within the UAE or Qatar, they've developed extraordinarily good e-governance. In other words, if you write an email to a government official, you have the right to expect a response instantly or very close to that.
It helps that these countries are small. I think if that kind of thing happens in a situation like a New England town meeting, that kind of exchange can happen in a situation which doesn't have the immense geographic spread of the United States.
I would be careful in that. Saudi Arabia is a country of 25 million, an enormous state in its own right. Multiple hours across from one part of it to the other. It's a different type of society. It's a different type of structure. And indeed, the point of developing e-governance actually is to continue that feeling of intimacy with government, of direct connection with government in a context which there are, say, in a city of a million people, you can still have that intimacy with governance.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's an ancient tradition that has not been rooted out by the fact of oil.
In fact, it's almost been enhanced, that rulers have felt that they, as they've had all this wealth and these other things, that they've needed to continue those traditions as a way of reminding people, of building traditions and other things, to almost give people the confidence that as they enter the modern world, their older structures still very much exist.
And this is one of the things that you've talked about, actually, to me in private conversations, and talk about it to a degree in the book, which is the extent to which something like a revolution, a renaissance, is happening in the Arab world, in which the older traditions are being maintained at the same time that newer traditions are coming in. And in fact, some of the older traditions are being transmitted via the newer electronic media.
Right, or we can almost say new visions of these older traditions, repackaging of those older traditions are being done in various ways as well. But indeed, yes, new media, initially with the cassette tape, that had an enormous impact, just this little cassette tape that helped spawn the Iranian Revolution, helped give people who agreed with bin Laden an enormous voice within Saudi Arabia, for instance, how technology like satellite communications can transform how these societies operate in a hurry.
This is a deep theme in your book. The impact of technological change is one of the four themes that you mentioned. I want to talk a little bit more about that. The problem of television. We think of an autocratic state as controlling the media, controlling radio and television, which to an extent is true in the United States. Very hard to find independently minded broadcasters saying something other than what the government wants them to say. Not easy. KPFA tries to be one of those, but it's not easy to find them here. Now, what happens in these countries? Does the government manage to gobble up all the available?
No, and this is a context where training as American scholars can get in the way of understanding other societies. We tend to, as scholars, kind of assume that we can take our assumptions out of America and plop them somewhere else. Doesn't work like that. In America, it's very difficult for Americans to see radio broadcasts or television broadcasts from other states, other countries, because we're so large. In the Middle East.
Also because we don't speak the language.
We don't speak the language, but most Americans don't watch, say, Canadian television.
Yeah,
which is
absolutely.
Which is in English.
Yeah.
But in the Middle East, that's very different. In the Middle East, you may have multiple broadcasters broadcasting all around the world, all around the region, in one language, even though there may be great political differences between, say, Egypt during the Cold War period and Saudi Arabia. Indeed, the equivalence that I make is towards East and West Germany, two states that were right next to each other during the Cold War, which had broadcasting and television aimed at each other, yet had diametrically opposed political views of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing happens in this part of the world. And if you don't control radio broadcasts,
which the monarchs do not.
That's correct.
There are state-sponsored stations, but
nobody watches them. Nobody watches them. That raises fundamental questions about how the control of information happens. And indeed, this is important because many political scientists in the field, historians saw the advent of Al Jazeera, this satellite television program, as this unique revolutionary thing that would broadcast in Arabic to the rest of the Arab world. Well, actually, if you go back in time and look at the 1940s and 50s, or even back to the 30s with the advent of first radio and then television in the Arab world, you had the same impact. You had, you know, channels broadcasting over a long phase. It comes back to the basic assumption that the only television that people watch are broadcast within their borders. That comes from an American context and has nothing to do with the reality on the ground.
That ain't the way it is. Yeah.
Indeed, Saudi Arabia built one of the largest television towers in the world in the 60s, larger than the Empire State Building, on its border, on its sort of far, far eastern border close to Kuwait. Well, did they do it because there were large populations of Saudis? Sure. But the real reason they did it was to broadcast to neighboring states.
Yes. And one of the things that you bring up in the book, and that's of considerable importance, is the extent to which Al Jazeera has reporters who speak the language.
Right. One of the things that Americans tend to forget when we go to this part of the world is that if you don't speak the language, that's a significant impediment that will limit the types of people you're going to talk to, people who speak English.
And you got to wonder about your interpreter. Is he going to?
That's correct. Yeah, indeed. Many of these states get exactly the type of news coverage they want because they have interpreters who can say, well, you don't want to go to that neighborhood or speak to him. You know, those are the types of controls. And if I can add one other thing about Al Jazeera, and that doesn't mean Al Jazeera hasn't had an impact. The ability of its reporters to speak the language allows them to go places and to cover things that other American reporters can't cover in the same way. And that makes for a huge difference. Most American reporters in the Middle East do not speak Arabic or do not speak the local languages. And that's going to fundamentally shift and fundamentally skew the view that they look at this part of the world.
One of the things you've just mentioned, which was that Americans don't listen to other kinds of television outside of America, only within the borders. But that really isn't true about the Internet. And I have friends, many, who go to the Internet for Al Jazeera. And
in fact, Al Jazeera, one of Al Jazeera's largest individual audiences, particularly for its English language channels, I want to say third or fourth largest in the world, is based in the United States. People are interested in, yes, the Internet has allowed for of an enormous intake of information by Americans. You can read foreign language newspapers in a way that you couldn't be able to do as easily in the past, or see foreign language television programs. Can I make an additional point about
sure.
technology? One of the things I think that has been wildly overlooked, and in part goes with living in this part of the world, is air conditioning. Air conditioning has as an impact, a dramatic impact on daily life in this part of the world is about as oil. You cannot function in societies that have 100 degrees during the summer, if not more, for extended periods of time, plus humidity, without air conditioning. Air conditioning allows you to build large, modern societies that look like the United States.
Also, there are health questions. You mentioned, actually, that it was notable if you were an Englishman or an American who was sent to the Middle East, very likely you'd have some kind of health problems before you came back. You might even die there.
In fact, many of them did. And in fact, it was known as the white man's graveyard.
Yeah.
Because of that, yes. So, yeah, air conditioning as a technology is as transformative as oil, if not more so.
Sure.
I mean, indeed, a British report in the 30s noted that air conditioning alone added 2 to 3 hours a day of productive work. That's an enormous amount of time.
Right. It also, I think, affects the mood in which you're going to do your work. If you are comfortable, if you are physically comfortable, you're able to work a lot better. You're able to think a lot better than if you are not.
And you also will be healthier.
And you will be healthier.
And
yeah.
That's going to change population growth. It's also going to change the types of people who can work in this environment.
Mm-hmm.
The large increase in expatriate workers, particularly from Europe and the United States, would have been inconceivable without the advent of air conditioning.
Now, it's one of the things that seem to go together. I'm not sure if you make this point, and I may be inaccurate in this, but there seems to be a kind of connection between the enormous diversity of a state like Saudi Arabia and many of the other Arab states, the enormous diversity, and the diversity of cultural exchange that's also happening there. That is to say, they listen to a whole bunch of different kinds of television stations because there are a whole bunch of different kinds of people.
Absolutely. And all different types of people are listening to different types of broadcasts. There are political parties that are organized that political candidates, for instance. There are enough Filipinos in Saudi Arabia, for instance, to give you an idea of the diversity, that Philippine political candidates fly to Saudi Arabia or the Gulf and campaign there or ask for contributions.
India as well, I take it, is an important player.
Oh, absolutely. India is an important player, both because of its populations on the ground, but also because of its economic impact. And I should add that it's not just those populations, Americans. Barack Obama, for instance, mm-hmm. when he ran for president, solicited contributions from Americans who live in the Middle East in places like Dubai or Qatar.
Yeah, yeah. And as you mentioned, there's a lot of religious diversity. There are Jews, there are Catholics, there are all kinds of people. And even if there is a state-sponsored religion, not an official state
right.
religion, but a state-sponsored religion, other religions are very much tolerated. And something we don't really – we can see it in our own country. We can see Catholics who don't believe in the Pope.
Right.
You know, Catholics who don't agree with the Pope. There's lots of that kind of thing. Christians who say, "Well, you know, I'm Christian, yeah, but I don't follow everything that every
right.
Every Christian does." That kind of thing. The loose relationship to a religion as one element of various elements of a culture, only one element of various elements of a culture. People don't tend to think of the Arabic world in that way. They tend to think of it as monolithic, a bad word for trying to understand anything.
No, and diversity that has always been there, and people moving back and forth in these societies that precisely say that. Indeed, when we think about religious toleration, we talk about Muslims living with Christians, we think of Europe. But in reality, this part of the world where there are tens of thousands of Christians who live, who work, who practice their faith freely should be thought of as well as an enormous success story.
Yes, yeah.
Toleration, absolutely. Indeed. One of my chapters talks about toleration and accommodation in the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
These are societies where most people believe that there are no Christians, that there are no churches. No, it's never worked like that in the past, And it will never work like that in the future.
Yeah, there's you don't use the word Orientalism, and I know there are lots of problems with that word these days. But one of the things you do say, which is an important thing to say, I think one of the deepest things you say in the book, is that these are normal states. These are not exotic states. We have to treat them the way we treat France or anything else or Italy or anything in Europe, that these are states that have all the problems that states have, and we don't treat them that way. We don't think of them in that way.
No, we think of them as something different and exotic. And if we begin to compare them to other states, a good example, I think, of the United States, we don't think of ourselves as a society in which oil is the dominant political structure. But the price of oil, the price of gas, is one of the most important tangible things that everybody knows. And if gas, say, doubles or triples, that will have a political impact in the United States of an enormous magnitude.
It sure will. It sure will. We're an oil state, just like...
Right. And if you don't believe me, the folks down in the Gulf of Mexico know otherwise.
They certainly do. Now, there are many, many... One of the interesting things about this book is, while it is an analytical book, and part of what makes it a very good book. While it is an analytical book, Sean is a storyteller. He loves to tell stories. He tells me stories all the time, and he always has since he was a child. And these are stories. There are plenty of stories in the Arab Gulf states beyond oil and Islam. It sounds like a challenging intellectual argument, and it is. But there are also lots of very pleasurable and funny and interesting stories that Sean likes to tell. Storytelling is an important aspect of his understanding the world, of his learning, that he, in fact, tells the story of how he learned, began to question the whole Rentier model and what people were saying. It's a story. I think that's quite wonderful, and it's an aspect of the book that makes it very readable. Now, there's a story that we want to talk about here, which you've called in an article about it, but it's in the book, Airlift for Allah. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Airlift for Allah is a remarkable story. It's a story in 1952 where the United States airlifted several thousand Muslims who had been stranded in Beirut to make it to Mecca, Jeddah first, then to Mecca, on time for the Hajj. And it's a story that begins with an idea by a Beirut employee, a Christian, no less, who decides that he realizes he's got all these people who are stranded. And in fact...
Now, what happened? They oversold tickets.
Yeah, what happened? Let me back up for a second. 1952 was the first year that the Saudis had much more money from oil than they had ever had in the past. So they reduced the fees that were paid for Hajj pilgrims. And so lots of people suddenly converged.
They all want to go to Mecca.
They all want to go to Mecca.
And they want to fly.
And they want to fly. Well, it's the easiest way to get there and the quickest way to get there. The other forms of transportation, and until quite recently, much of that transportation from other parts of the Muslim world to Mecca was done via boat. All those were filled. So the idea would be that they could get on air and fly from Beirut. And, you know, entrepreneurial people who ran these airlines said, we could make a money-making opportunity, and began selling tickets to lots of people, including prominent Muslims from the Arab world, but also from Pakistan, from Iran, and Turkey as well. In fact, Turkey the same year had allowed for more of its Muslims to go on Hajj. So thousands of people converge on Beirut, sold tickets, but with nowhere to go. And there wasn't enough tickets, planes, private planes to fly them. And so a man named Edward DeBoss, a Christian, no less, was the head of the airport at the time, tried to figure out what to do. He sent letters, tried to communicate with American or European airlines. They said, no, we don't have the space. We think these people are not worth flying. So at the last minute, and he's a remarkable person. He was American trained. He had gone to Lehigh and also to
Princeton, I believe.
Harvard, I believe. Yeah, Harvard as well. And had been a graduate of the American University in Beirut. And knew the American community, including the ambassador. And at the last minute said, hey, why don't I ask the ambassador for help? What's the worst that could happen?
Yes.
The ambassador said, yeah, this is a good idea. Sent a telegram to Washington. And at the end of the Truman administration, they got a quick response from the Defense Department. They said, okay, this is a good idea. The only thing we ask is that we'll put everybody on the plane. We won't charge them anything, and we'll see this as a humanitarian gesture. And so,
in fact, they fed them.
They fed them overnight. They flew 14, 15 planes from Europe. They saw it as an exercise, as a military exercise. They had just done the Berlin airlift.
Mm-hmm.
So many of the pilots in the United States Air Force who had participated in the Berlin airlift participated in this airlift, and they had a very difficult operation. They had to get several thousand people from Beirut to Mecca before the start of the Hajj. They had a deadline of almost 2 to 3 days, and they did it.
It was quite wonderful, and there were some anti-Americans, as there were many,
yeah.
You know, et cetera. What did they have to say about that operation?
Well, the most remarkable one was a man named Khashoggi, who's a major a political and religious figure within Iran in 1952. He was stunned by what happened. He had been a major anti-American cleric, had supported a man named Mossadegh, the prime minister at the time, and indeed became, in part because of the airlift. Came back to Iran afterwards and became pro-American and actually effectively supported a coup that would take place a year later. A sort of remarkable example of public diplomacy in the best sense of the word. We gave people an opportunity to fly and to make a religious obligation. It had ripple effects throughout the Muslim and Arab world. It stunned the population.
It was wonderful, and he said that we must remember. I mean, he was a holy man. He said that we must remember to include the Americans, though they are infidels.
Yeah, this is actually a Lebanese religious figure said that, and it was sort of a remarkable thing to see. Sort of infidels though they are. Yeah, the newspaper accounts as well, sort of saying, well, maybe the Americans might be okay. They might, you know, they've done some bad things with Israel, but maybe they're going to be okay. You know, maybe God has a good plan for them.
Allah's working with them too.
Working with them as well. Sort of
they're
remarkable.
Not necessarily
thing.
Satan.
But it's almost inconceivable today to think of the American Air Force doing a similar type of operation.
And it was never done again.
Not quite, but pretty not done in the same way again. That's right. The new administration under Eisenhower made a decision that we did not want to do these type of operations under the assumption that the Lebanese or other Muslims would expect us to fly them on Hajj. We said, look, we're not going to do this. But subsequently, smaller operations did take place later, but nothing like this, nothing as public as this as well.
And it was a wonderful gesture. Now, we're talking about 50 years ago, but over 50 years ago, it was 1952. And it was just a tremendous idea.
And it vanished. It vanished from these...
People don't know about it. This is something you dug up.
Yeah, I happened to find it actually. This was where I found about it. It wasn't in American diplomatic documents, although I went back and found it. I found it while reading British diplomatic documents from Saudi Arabia where they were talking about this airlift. And it's very amusing reading these British diplomatic documents because, A, they're very angry and envious of what the Americans can do in the 50s, and in fact they say openly, well, these Americans are running an empire here, and if there's anyone who knows what an empire should look like,
right,
it's them. And in fact it's amusing to think of this, because Americans like to believe, well, we don't have an empire.
Only bad guys have empires.
Only the British and the French.
Yeah,
have
we're
empires.
Not imperialistic.
And this is one thing we have to take the British on faith. If they think we have an empire, then we probably do. They know what one looks like.
Yes, indeed. Sean, there's lots more to talk to you about this book. We haven't even mentioned the first feature-length Saudi Arabian movie, Kaif Al-Hal. How are you? Yes, a great, interesting film. You can find out about it on the Internet Movie Database. That's about all we have time for today.
Google. It's actually on Google Video as well, if you want to see it.
Okay. Oh, it is. So you can see it.
You can see it on video. It's worth watching. It's a very funny movie.
Okay. Fantastic. Now, we've been talking about the Arab Gulf States Beyond Oil and Islam. That's from Lynn Reiner Publishers. Lynn is L-Y-N-N-E. Reiner is R-I-E-N-N-E-R. And the author is my son, Sean Foley, who is probably familiar to some of you people out there in Radio Land, because he's been the force behind certainly all of the programming that I've done about Arab poetry and that sort of thing. Wonderful book, The Arab Gulf States Beyond Oil and Islam. Go get it. Thank you, Sean.
Shukran jazilan. Thank you.
Shukran. That's shukran, I meant to say. This is Jack Foley. Two events. Catherine Hastings' Word Temple Series will be this Saturday at 7 p.m. at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts, 6780 Depot Street, Sebastopol. It'll be an evening of translations featuring work by Jorge Luis Borges and Luis Cernuda, as well as by Vietnamese poet Yu Cai Trai. That's this Saturday. On Sunday, from 3 to 6:30, Rebecca's Books, 3268 Adeline, will have a tremendous farewell blast. The store is sadly closing, but it's going out with a bang. Rebecca's Books this Sunday, 3 to 6:30, 3268 Adeline Street in Berkeley, north of Alcatraz. I'll be back in a week with John Bennett. Thank you, Miss M. Thanks for listening.
Oakland-based Urban Gardens, OBUX, invites you to join us for our third annual art and garden tour.
Guests will embark on a lively journey through a West Oakland children's garden and exclusive architect's gardens.
Don't miss the opportunity to enjoy live music while discovering spectacular gardens with amazing views.
All proceeds will benefit OBUG's programs providing urban gardening to West Oakland kids.
Please join us from 1 p.m. through 6 p.m. on Saturday, July 24th, to support sustainable communities.
Tickets are available online through brownpapertickets.com or call 510-